sales teams, marketing teams, we're all dying in systems, right? We're so busy updating our systems and making sure our systems are upgraded. We don't have time to like be human, make that connection, like actually understand what the buyer wants and really make that human connection.
I'm Jonathan Gandolf, and welcome to the Content Cocktail Hour, powered by Audience Plus. Our mission is to shake out the deepest secrets of B2B marketing professionals and stir up fresh conversation, all to help you connect your brand with the right audience at the right time. Let's raise a glass. Welcome back to the Content Cocktail Hour. Jonathan Gandolf here, founder and CEO of Audience Plus. I'm thrilled to be joined by one of my favorite marketers, but more than that, just one of my favorite people in B2B SaaS and go-to-market. I've collaborated with this individual at several places, maybe unintentionally or intentionally. I'm not entirely sure. I would guess if anybody has been a part of anything in B2B SaaS and go-to-market, they've probably crossed paths with this guest, well, knowingly or unknowingly, because she's involved in about everything. It is Karthi today from Audience House. She is the co-founder of Audience House. She's been involved previously in Go-to-Market Partners. She's involved in Rev Genius and everything they're building at Audience House as well. Karthi, I am excited to dive into a lot of different things today, but especially what you're up to now, because I think you're kind of on fire and I want to be involved in anything you're involved in. So we'll dig into all of that today. But Karthi, in your own words, tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, what you're up to now.
Hey, Jonathan. Thanks for having me. So you're from Audience Plus and I'm from Audience House. It's quite serendipitous in my opinion. And of course, you are my favorite people and we've known each other for like 3 years now, right? Weirdly, through Go-to-Market Partners events. So I actually come from very much an open source community building background. I'm a very community building purist, if you might add, because if anyone who knows open source and community building in the open source world, it's very much inherently adhering to the concepts of community and meritocracy and all of that stuff, right? And where the community gets to vote and decide on the future of the products and stuff like that. Transitioning from that, I've been a part of a couple of exits and helped companies scale to $100 million. Then, of course, I was director of GTM at Go-to-Market Partners, where we built from 0 to 5 million. At that point, some point last year, I really felt like I had this moment of clarity where I really felt like, do I really want to be working for other people or do I want to be building something of my own? Jared and I have been talking about building something on our own for like ages, like a couple of years since I met him. Finally, I met him because I was courting him to be a speaker at a GTM Partners event, virtual event on RevOps. And that's how we became friends. And Jared wanted me to build something with him. And I always said no. And suddenly last year in like June, July, I was like, I want to do this. Let's do this. So we've been conceptualizing what to do. And Jared's always been pushing for something towards community building. And I wasn't sure whether that was the way to go. And then we kind of landed up on audience building, owned audience and movement marketing, which is really what I love to do, which is to create impact and bring joy to other people.
I love it. I'm excited to dig into it all today. I can't help but recall now as you're recounting this story.
Yeah.
The Magic Castle event that Go-to-Market Partners hosted in Los Angeles. Jared was there. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, maybe the magic started there. No pun intended.
No, actually, the magic started before that. So I've known Jared now for a better part of 3 years. And he'd always been wanting to do something with me, right? And so he always asked me, Karthi, we have to do something together. We have to do something together. And I'm like, now's not the right time. I was fully committed to Go-to-Market Partners. And then, you know, when you work for a company and you're so fully committed, but suddenly you come to this inflection point where you feel like you've done everything for that company, but you want to do more. That's when I called Jared and said, let's do it. I asked him 3 questions and he passed the test. So then that's how we became co-founders.
Love it. Well, so let's start on kind of your marketing journey. And then I'm going to circle back to that entrepreneurial journey because I think what you just mentioned kind of resonates with me as well. Maybe we can compare some notes there. But Karthi, this is the Content Cocktail Hour. So we have to ask all of our guests, what are you enjoying drinking nowadays?
Just water, Jonathan.
Just water. That's a good answer. That's the healthiest answer we can have here. I myself need to do a better job of drinking water. I'm trying to mix it in today. Probably too much coffee in my life here recently. So cool. Well, okay. So let's dig into more of the meat of the conversation here. So you're co-founder of Audience House with Jared Robin. People might know Jared from Rev Genius founder, and he's got a big LinkedIn following, always sharing kind of his unique perspective on the B2B SaaS space, and he doesn't come from that space. So I always think his perspective is a bit unique and valuable in that way. But what I've seen you and him talking a lot about right now with Audience House is movement marketing. You previewed it a little bit, but maybe just tell us first what movement marketing means.
So movement marketing fundamentally is, and like historically, whether it's social, economical, or political, right, or even like brands, it's fundamentally having people rally around this idea or a person. It's usually around building a better future for yourself or finding a purpose or challenging the status quo. It's very much about challenging the status quo, whether you're a brand, whether you're a religion, whether you're a social, you know, status, or whether it's political, right? And movement marketing goes like all the way back to like the Egyptian era, like the first recorded movement that people build, and cults and everything. Those are all born from this idea of movement marketing, right? So how political leaders get elected, that's because they are good at building movements. Like MAGA is a movement. When you really go deep into movement marketing, you can see some similarities in that it's usually challenging the status quo, right? Something people are unhappy about, where you're trying to give them a different future. It always needs to have a face. It has to have a person that people can rally behind, whether it's like Gandhi in India, you know, rallying for independence. And it's also grounded in some kind of an ethos. So for example, in the case of Gandhi, it was nonviolence. Like his whole movement was built around, we're going to get independence, but it's going to be nonviolent. Like we're not going to be fighting the British, right? There were still fights happening, but that wasn't the fundamental call to arms, as you were, of the movement. It was nonviolence, it was grounded in nonviolence. And again, similarly, Mandela, that was a different approach. Like after being in jail and everything, like he wanted an end to the apartheid. He could have gone a different way. He didn't. He built a better future for his people by rallying a movement. Steve Jobs did this really well with Apple, right? Where he created this, I think it really started with that campaign of, this is for the weirdos, the round, you know, in a square peg. This is for the different ones. This is for the people who think differently. If you really analyze that ad, the genius behind that ad was, I call it, it's exclusive but still inclusive. And what I mean by that is the ad very specifically calls out and says, this is for people who are different. And we all think we're different, right? So it's exclusive in that it says, it's for people who are different. Yeah. It's inclusive because we all think we're different.
Yeah, I've never really thought about it that way, but you're right. It's like inclusive and exclusive at the same time. The other campaign that was coming to mind as you were talking through that for me, and I come from this ecosystem, so maybe it's a little bit more closer to home, but Salesforce, when they first started, they ran this anti-software campaign, and the whole irony of it was that they were software, right? But yeah, it was a movement, and I think you're on something there. It's so funny as you like mentioned it, it goes back to the Egyptians. It's like less about marketing and more about human psychology, and it is so old school, but like in a time-tested, like strong, like psychological way. But like, why now? Like why, and maybe let me hypothesize on it for a moment, but it's like everything in B2B SaaS, and we might talk about this a little bit later, but like feels like we had gamed the system a little bit with paid advertising, pay-per-click, account-based marketing, intent data, like inbound marketing. Like everything, we have all strived, myself included, as B2B marketers to like make everything formulaic. And is this movement marketing kind of like a reaction to that? Or like, why is now the time that B2B marketers and SaaS marketers need to think about movements as opposed to maybe some of the algorithms we've learned to game over the last decade or so?
Yeah. So Jonathan, I think you and I can both agree. We've all done this. Marketers ruin everything.
Yeah. As a former marketer, yeah.
You see, you find a play that works, you replicate it so much that it doesn't work anymore.
Exactly.
The reason why it's important now, but outside of that, is because we were so always used to doing things like in a linear manner, like incrementally, right?
Yeah.
AI has changed the game that it allows us to do things in an exponential manner, right? In a quantum manner, you could leapfrog. So when you do that, the old playbooks, like even what worked yesterday doesn't work today. The algorithms are catching up. Everybody is smarter, faster, better, right? So in such an environment, how do you stand out? Like, how do you build something that stands the test of time? If Apple were to build today, how would they do things differently, right? Like, so you have to break things down to first principles and really think about going back to like Henry Ford and stuff like that. And I've written about this. Do you need a faster horse, or are you trying to, you know, like, you're not trying to get a faster horse. You're trying to change the entire ecosystem, right? And that spawned infrastructure, road infrastructure, and everything that it is today. I mean, Ubers wouldn't exist if the first cars didn't come. Tesla wouldn't exist if the first. So it has this exponential effect when you challenge the norm, when you challenge the status quo, and really move people to like a different way of thinking. And that's why movement marketing is specifically important now, because marketers are finding out that we actually can't ruin anything right now because nothing works.
Yeah.
The only way to do it is to tap into human psychology, as you said, which is like, we're very tribal in nature. That's how we're built, right? We always have this us versus them mentality. We've always had that because, like, back in the day when civilization wasn't as advanced as it is today, we've had to be very tribal. We had to get into groups and communities and build for ourselves. And those communities usually rallied around a cause. So now you have to get people to rally behind you and rally behind your cause. That's literally the only way to do it. And we saw this over the weekend. Like, what's going to happen to companies if you put tens of thousands of dollars into building your LinkedIn page and it was shut down like Apollo and Seamless? Yeah. What are you going to do if people can't identify with you as something bigger than just a LinkedIn page? Where would you create demand? So you need to be known for something outside of all of these channels so that even if you lose all of this, people are still going to rally behind you.
Yeah, I mean, we've all read about the, like, technology can't really be your moat anymore because it's so replicable. So I think this movement marketing is well-timed, and I think you're exactly right. Like, we all need to build brand and what we're known for outside of just tech, because that's going to become easier to replicate, harder to defend. And I love the idea. It's kind of like a zig when they zag playbook as well. You know, so many people, you mentioned the linear. I mean, I've been, again, guilty of this in my past. It's like you find that channel and you just, if it's working, you just hammer it until you see law of diminishing returns. And I think, like, right now, a lot of marketers are seeing, like, diminishing returns in almost all channels because it's becoming so noisy. And so the only way to cut through that noise is with movement marketing. So I think that's really powerful. I think, and correct me if I'm maybe misnaming this or this isn't the right nomenclature, but I think one of the movements you're maybe a part of or helping inspire is the human first movement, human first sales movement. We all know and are familiar with all of the AI solutions that are being built. It seems like there's 1,000 companies helping sales reps, people supporting sales reps with AI. Some of them fantastic, some of them maybe not. I'm not entirely sure. You know, we can't possibly sample them all, but I know you're helping one company build this human first movement. Maybe talk about, like, the early returns and the early experiences of what you're seeing with that specific movement.
Yeah, so Amos, who's like the co-founder and CEO of Swan, their AI, so they de-anonymize in very fundamental terms, they de-anonymize website visitors and a lot more than that. When he came to us and said, hey guys, I really want to do this. How do we do this? So one of the core things we told him was that, is he willing to be the face of the movement? Is he willing to evangelize his point of view? And he was like, yes. And then we really got to talking, and it's really interesting how he framed it, which is, he's an AI native company that doesn't believe AI should replace humans, but it should be used to empower humans, right? So going back to first principles, and Jonathan, you know this really well, sales teams, marketing teams, we're all dying in systems, right? We're so busy updating our systems, making sure our systems are upgraded, making sure they're integrated and they're working well together and debugging them. We don't have time to, like, be human, make that connection, like, actually understand what the buyer wants and really make that human connection, right? And this is very much true for the sales process, which is, like, sales teams are dying, buried in just admin work, right? Mm-hmm. They don't have time to make the human connection and build relationships. So we thought, okay, how do we take that data point and turn it into something that also supports what Amos's fundamental ethos is about for building the company, right? Which is why we're starting to build this narrative for Swan, which is around, like, how do you build a business where you're empowering human beings, and using AI to do all of the grunt work, but humans are allowed to be human. Jump on more podcasts, talk to more of your customers, talk to you about, and just really just be human. And that's where I think AI can really support us, because we see it as a threat, but in fact, what we should see it as is that it allows us the ability to go back to being human again, right? Because it allows us to not be dying in systems, updating systems, looking for data in systems. AI can do all of that for us. What AI can't do is this, having a conversation with you, building a relationship, right? So that's what AI can't do. It gives us time back. And with that, of course, there's always a yin and a yang, right? But with that is, while you can empower people, there's a very specific set of people who can work in such an environment, right? So it's also about, part of Swan's ethos is, how do I build a 10 million ARR company or a 20 million, 100 million ARR company, but not add more bodies to the problem? And what I mean by that is less human, but augmented by AI. Like, how do I get the best and brightest people working on this thing without the old VC model where if I double the investment, can you triple the revenue by adding more SDRs and bodies to the problem? Yeah, that doesn't exist anymore, right? That doesn't exist because AI can augment a lot of that stuff, right? So that's where I think, yes, human first, but there's definitely going to be humans. It's funny because with AI, it almost feels like we're going back to, civilization is going back to like understanding like Darwinism. It really is going to be survival of the fittest. And in this context, fittest are people who adopt AI better, faster, and more differently. People who embrace AI as opposed to people who repel AI. So every single person out there should be looking to become some kind of a creator, not
That's the AI company leading a human first movement. Like, the irony of that, and I sound like a broken record, is again, it's very similar to that Salesforce campaign, right? Where it's like anti-software, but it's software. This is like anti-AI, but it's AI, right? And like, I don't know, there's some parallels there that I think are really interesting. And I think from what I can tell from the outside, looking in, are working. I mean, every time I see Amos post, like, the thing's going viral. And I think like he truly, genuinely is starting a movement. So kudos to you all and your work there. And then I've been in the room where we're throwing bodies at a problem. At the business I started before, or at the business I was at before starting The Juice, which is now Audience Plus, SDRs reported into marketing. And we ran that exact math, right? It's like, we're not seeing diminishing returns yet. The SDRs are paying for themselves. Let's hire more bodies. And we did that. And then things slowed down. And then what you have to do is you have to cut those bodies, right? And it's like, that was just the hazard of doing business. And man, like, saying that out loud makes me feel so gross. And like, there's a better way now. And I think you all are a part of it. So maybe last question I'll ask on this movement marketing, and then I want to hear a little bit of your entrepreneurial story here. But you mentioned earlier the movement marketing has to have a face to it. You mentioned Amos, the founder of Swan, being the face of that movement. Selfishly, does the leader of the movement, as far as brands are concerned, does it need to be the founder or executive, or can that face be something else or somebody different?
It can be something else or somebody different. But the risk is, which is why we always try to go with a founder or co-founder, is if that person moves on, they tend to take your movement with you because they're the face of the brand and they're the person people identify with, which is why we're very prescriptive about making sure it's somebody who has longevity in the company. That's the face of the brand, right? Or face of the movement rather, not the brand. Because if they move on, then the movement moves with them, right? Because like, for example, Martin Luther King moved on, right? Yeah. The movement would move with him, right? And if Gandhi moved on, the movement would move with him. If Mandela moved on, we try really hard to make sure it's the founder. The other reason, Jonathan, candidly, and you know this as a founder, is most founders are stuck in founder-led sales, especially now. There's a massive shift even in bigger companies, which I'm sure you're seeing as well. It's very much gravitating back towards the founder, like wanting to be part of the founder. So our whole thing with movement marketing and hinging it with the founder is, if the founder is going to be stuck in a founder-led sales motion anyway, whether that's day-to-day selling or just being a part of the sales process in some way, shape, or form, why don't we just leverage that to make sure that the founder-led sales motion scales? Like, how do we make them the evangelist?
Yeah, that's really good. I've seen that play out in our organization and other organizations. I think that's a a really good point. Let's talk about your entrepreneurial journey just a little bit. You mentioned something earlier where you felt like you had reached like your own kind of cap on what you could learn, what you could contribute at a place, and you're weighing kind of working for others versus working on your own. I've had that similar experience throughout my career. I always say like, I get myself in trouble when I get bored, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like in every career step, every career change that I've made or step in my career journey has been because I felt like I was, yeah, just bored or stagnant at that spot. And I've made some weird career moves because of that, but it's all worked out fine to this point, I think. I don't know, to be determined, I guess. But for others, I think like right now is an interesting point in kind of the macro environment where there are a lot of people considering making that leap into doing their own thing, whether that's the fractional environments become very popular. Entrepreneurship, obviously, a lot of people are always drawn to that. For people who are out there and maybe weighing that same question of like, do I want to continue working for others or do I want to go take a risk and do something on my own or with somebody else? And they're reaching that inflection point. How do you encourage them to maybe try to march through that decision in a way where it doesn't just feel like they're going with whichever way the wind is blowing that day?
Yeah. So for me, the toughest decision was the financial aspect. Rather than, as you know, because when you're with a company, your paycheck is guaranteed, right? You know where your next paycheck is coming from. And especially if you're like a self-starter and you know you can deliver, you know where your next paycheck is coming from. Whereas the entrepreneurial journey is scary because at the initial, especially the initial few years, you don't really know economically where you're going to be at. So that was definitely a huge, huge part that probably is what held me back a few years. If not, I probably would have started earlier in my career, right? The entrepreneurial journey. But I think we all reach that point where something, and boredom is definitely like a big part of it for me, where I felt like I could be doing more, like I could be doing this differently, right? If I were this person, how would I do this differently? I think we all reach that point, regardless of what your socioeconomic status is, where you have this inch and you have to scratch it. Otherwise, you're going to regret it forever. But once you reach that point, you got to go for it. Like, at least that's how it was for me, right? Like, I just knew if I didn't do this, that I also, like, I reached a point in my career where I was like, what do I want to do? Do I want to get a C-level title? Like, I thought I was getting a little bit unhireable, but in a good way where, like, because I was always bringing my entrepreneurial spirit into the company. Like, I always went close to revenue, building revenue and building the company. At a certain point, that kind of makes you a little unhireable because you don't really want to follow the rules. I'm not a rule follower. You tell me I can't do something, that's when I will absolutely go do that. And I'll give you an anecdote. I remember I was working at this company and I used to always go into office around 6-7 in the morning, right? Always. Then HR brought this new rule saying, whatever time you come in, you have to swipe your badge. As soon as the rule was brought in, those were the days I would forget to bring my badge to office.
Smart.
Because I didn't want to be tired. I didn't want to be clocked, right? I didn't want to be on the clock. If you left me alone, I would work for 12, 16 hours. But if you were clocking me, I would. So I'm very much not. You tell me I can't do something, that's when I challenge the status quo. Not good with rules, but that makes you unhireable. We at a certain point, and you know this.
I would have hired you. You're hireable.
Yeah, but specific types of people you can work with, right? Who allow you to break rules. So basically, Jared is a rebel, and I don't look like a rebel because I usually look like somebody who's a rules follower, but I'm really not. So it worked out in the end.
Yeah, I love that, and I appreciate the kind of transparency of the financial implications. I think a lot of times, like, that's not something people talk about out loud. I'm reminded of a conversation I had with Alexine Moudoir, who's the founder of Women in Sales. And she kind of said the same thing, like, that's a big step. I mean, I've felt that myself. You know, I took a pay cut to start The Juice, and I've maintained that pay cut since. And it's like, it's a very real thing that I think more people should be comfortable talking about out loud. And there are ways to mitigate that. I think I'm out of a venture studio model, so there are some trade-offs there between salary and equity, and that's all kind of negotiable as well. So, you know, I think that can be a very real holdup. But if anybody's interested in learning about some ways around that, always happy to talk to them as well. And again, appreciate you talking about that out loud, because I do think that's real.
I had a mentor early on, and I'm going to use a little bit of my French here, pardon my French. And Jonathan, he told me early on, he said, Kathy, always make sure you have fuck you money. And what he meant by that is enough money in the bank to just walk away from a bad situation and be able to build something for yourself. So I'd known that always, and I'd worked towards that. So having that allowed me to, in a funny way, I put that money aside to walk away from bad situations in like a company. But having that allowed me to make a more informed and financially independent decision about going through the entrepreneurial journey. If somebody, I guess from my point of view, of course, you have more experience with the venture studio setup and all of that. But if someone's just bootstrapping, a good way to do it is to just plan it out financially. Yep. Give yourself a nest egg so that you can walk towards it.
Yeah, love that. So good. Thanks for sharing that. All right, Karthi, the last question we always ask all of our guests. You're excited about this one. You previewed it with me, and I'm excited about this one. What's an unpopular opinion that you have as it pertains to B2B marketing?
Okay, I have massive, massive problems. And Jonathan, I know I've told you about this, and we bonded over this. I have massive problems with anything in front of the marketer title, especially revenue marketer, growth marketer, demand marketer. I have huge problems with all of this because I think that's inherently what marketing is supposed to do. So why are we trying to differentiate it by saying I'm a revenue marketer as opposed to what? Because marketing is in service of revenue, nothing else. Marketing is in service of growth, nothing else. Marketing is in service of creating demand, nothing else. So why are we now different types of marketers as opposed to just being marketers and doing the job that we're supposed to do, which is sales at scale?
Go off. I love it. I love it so much. I come from the what you would define as the demand gen data side of marketing. Yeah. And I've always struggled with kind of the same thing you have. I had somebody tell me early in my career, the closer you are to the revenue number, the safer your job is and the faster you'll grow. That was always my goal with marketing. So then as I led marketing teams, even with things like brand initiatives, it's like the output of that brand project might not be dollars and cents, but you can reverse engineer that two or three steps and you're going to get a leading indicator to the lagging indicator that is revenue. And I think that's a lot of times a difference between a great marketer and just a good marketer is the ability to do that. So I love that. Anything in front of the marketing title, that's interesting. That's pretty broad. I kind of like it though. And you certainly rang the bell for
unpopular. Marketing is in service of revenue always. And that includes all those things.
I agree. We're in a strong alignment there. We could rant. Maybe we'll save that for another episode where Karthi and Jonathan just rant. Karthi, if people want to learn more about Audience House or learn more from you or learn more about movement marketing, what's the best way to do that?
So they could subscribe to the Audience House newsletter, which is audiencehouse.com, and there's a link and you can go subscribe to it. We talk about all kinds of interesting things, specifically grounded in movement marketing and breaking free of the sea of sameness, as we call it.
Ooh, I like that. The sea of sameness. Thank you to everybody. Thank you especially to Karthi for joining us today. To all of our watchers and listeners, until next time, same time, same place. Cheers.
Hi, Jonathan. Thank you.
Thank you for joining the Content Cocktail Hour powered by Audience Plus. If you want to see more episodes or more resources curated for your role, join us at audienceplus.com. See you next time. Same time, same place. Cheers.